Hello and welcome to IP in a Pod episode 4A. Today we thought we would talk about something that's pretty topical at the moment. I'm sure we've all seen that there's been a huge increase in the volume of creative content being posted online. Of course the coronavirus and the lockdown means that we've got loads more time on our hands at the moment. Not only has this provided quite a lot of entertainment for those of us stuck at home without a social life, but it's also flagged some really interesting legal arguments around the ownership of that content and the potential for these people to get themselves into trouble if they utilise content that they don't own or have the rights to use. Because of the enormity of this subject, we actually are going to look at this over two podcasts, hence why this is 4A. In 4A, we're going to look at what rights exist in content created at home and who owns them, including creations by employees, collaborations with other people, and the practicalities that surround this. And then in part two, the next podcast, we will look at the issues around using third-party content and the very tricky issues that can arise there. But I guess the first question is, what is copyright and what rights are we talking about here?
So, Pete, copyright is a type of intellectual property right. And although you're very familiar with it, some of our listeners might not be. So we thought you'd provide a sort of basic introduction. And I should mention just at the start, what we're going to be talking about today, but largely about copyright in England and Wales. Now, copyright is largely a matter of national law, and most, if not all, countries around the world have a copyright system. And there's a degree of harmonisation due to international conventions, including the Berne Convention for Protection of Literary and Artistic Works. But national laws do differ, so you should always seek advice from an appropriately qualified local attorney. Now, copyright is an unregistered right, so it comes into being automatically on the creation of a qualified work. It's also great because it means it's free. And the owner of a copyright in a work can prevent it from being reproduced by others without their consent. Now, what sorts of works are we talking about? Well, the main categories are things like literary, dramatic and musical works. So it might be marketing material, it might be a promotional, it might be some kind of skit, it might be a new song you've come up with. It could be artistic works, photographs, drawings, paintings, that sort of thing. It could be sound recordings, like the sound recording for his podcast. It could be a film. So this might cover some of the content that's being created, for example, for school children now being educated at home. Also covers broadcasts and the typographical arrangement of published editions of works. Now, there are a few qualifying criteria that are important to bear in mind. So one, for example, in relation to literary, dramatic and musical works is that they have to be recorded in some form. So just Pete and I having a chat, there wouldn't be any copyright in that. But as soon as that conversation's recorded, then copyright could subsist in both the content of the recording and separately in the recording itself. And for something to qualify for copyright protection, it also has to be original. So it can't solely be a copy of something else. And there are a few important differences in the way that the law treats the different categories of works. And one important consideration is the identity of the author of a work. So for literary, artistic and musical works, the author is the person or people who create it, the person who writes it, draws it or composes it. For a sound recording, it's the producer. So in that case, that's our colleague Danny, who's looking after a recording of the podcast. For a film, it's the producer and the principal director. And for a broadcast, it's the person making the broadcast. And for example, the duration of copyright also varies depending on the type of work in question. So for a literary work, it's the author's life plus 70 years. For a sound recording, it's 50 years from the year the sound recording was made, or 70 years from when it was first published or played in public, provided that happens within 50 years of its creation. Or in a film, it's 70 years from the calendar year of the death of the last of the principal director, author of the screenplay, author of the dialogue, or composer of music specially created for and used in the film. Now, that's looking quite some way ahead, but it's also always worth bearing in mind. Now, as a starting point, the first owner of copyright in a work is its author or authors, but that's not always the case.
Exactly, David, thank you. The general rule is that the creator, so the author of a copyright, is the work's owner. However, under English law, the intellectual property rights in works that are created by employees during the course of their employment automatically belong to their employer. Now, this is a position at law, it's just, it is what it is, but you'll often find it's usually clearly stated in an employee's employment contract, just to make sure that everybody's clear from the outset who owns what. Now, in the current climate, the boundaries of work time and personal time are somewhat blurred. A number of people have employee-owned equipment, or employer-owned equipment, sorry, that they've got at home with them to facilitate working from home. I'm hoping to have some screens up shortly, although sticking in the cables is somehow beyond us at the moment. And so now more than ever, care needs to be taken to separate work product, so work you're doing for your employer, from any creative content that you are just producing in your own capacity because you are creatively minded. Now, there's no hard and fast rules as to what constitutes work that's done during the course of employment, but there are some things that are sort of potential indicators. So, for example, if you are someone who's creative and using your employer's equipment to create the content, so thinking about maybe a whizzy bit of software which your employer has paid the license fee for. In those sort of circumstances, you might think that, that the employer would own that, created using that software. Similarly, if you're creating content as an individual that is the same as or very similar to what you normally do in your day-to-day job, then you may well be the case that that creative piece of work is owned by the employer, even though it wasn't directly said to you, oh, please create X for us today, thank you very much. Also, if you're creating, if the individual's creating work during their normal working hours, the 9 to 5, then again, that's possibly more likely a flag that something would belong to an employer. Although, of course, at the moment, lots of people are juggling childcare, volunteering, other commitments. And so querying whether anyone's really working in their normal working hours or if things are being done at funny times of the day. So that might be a sort of an additional factor to have to think about. I suppose thinking about what you can do to make things as clear as possible. Best practice would be to say, try to separate the work that you do on the clock from your own activities. Obviously, easier said than done if you are employed to be a, I don't know, something very sensible and dry, and actually in your secret life, you're creating incredibly funny memes that are being shared around the world. Look at the terms of employment contracts. That's usually a very clear indicator as to what you're employed to do. And if there's any doubts, it's always better to have an upfront discussion before content is created. If the individual gets some sort of acknowledgement from their employer that certain activities just fall outside the scope of their work, then that should be sufficient to protect the creations, and it saves any sort of awkward discussions later down the line where an employer decides that actually that the thing that's been created is rather quite nice, really rather quite nice, and they quite like it for themselves.
Thanks. Yeah, that's really interesting, Olivia. And I guess I was also thinking about how the issues arise when you collaborate with other people. Because really, we've been looking at so far at how works that an individual creates and the rights owned in that work. But actually, when there's several of you involved, it gets immensely more complicated. There's different ways that you can collaborate to create a protectable work. For instance, someone could write the lyrics to a song, someone else could write the music, someone else could perform that song, and someone else could film it. And that's actually probably quite a straightforward case, in that each person will own the copyright and their contribution, and their which would exist as an individual work. However, when people work together and their contribution cannot be distinguished from each other's, these are what we call works of joint authorship. For example, if two people work together to write the lyrics of a song and they haven't written separate parts of those lyrics, they've worked together to actually create the whole thing themselves between them. And this is important because each joint author has the same rights under English law as a sole author would have. So actually, even though you think you might have created something with your mate and you can do whatever you want with it, actually they own as much of it as you do, and your ownership is not separate from theirs, it's jointly with theirs. And so they could actually stop you from doing anything in the same way that you could stop them from doing anything, because you both have the same ownership rights in that piece of work.
Pete, I was wondering, is it obviously messier then if you are in the current climate when we're working in sort of different locations around the country, but say you're collaborating on something with a team member in a different territory, does that sort of make it more difficult?
Yes, that absolutely makes it more difficult. And as we've said, we're talking really about the law of England and Wales here, and how that applies. The application of the law here is when you would enforce it. So the ownership point is slightly separate. But under the international treaties that are in play, we have what's called the Berne Convention. And under Berne, there is a level of harmonisation around the world. So you can probably assume that in most territories, certainly most sort of developed country territories, they will have some concept of joint authorship, although we can't be sure without checking that it would be the same as our concept here. And actually under Berne, what countries have to do is give their citizens, give citizens of a third country the same right as their own citizens would have in that third country. So actually, technically, if the law is different in another country and you're collaborating with someone in that country, they might not have the same rights to joint authorship as if you were co-creating something with another person in the UK or in another territory. So it's a really interesting question, actually, Olivia, but it's the answer is infinitely complicated, and we'd have to look on a case-by-case basis, I think.
So what can we do when some of these slightly more complex scenarios come up? Because, I mean, in our case, with a podcast, it's quite straightforward. We're all employees of Charles Russell Speechleys, so that the firm, as our employer, will own all the rights in this podcast. But if we've got a situation of a sort that Pete's been talking about, where you've got collaborators, co-authors or joint authors, and people participating from different countries, even if you have within a large international group, you might have employees who are employed by different companies within your group, working together to produce materials. And I think the simplest thing is always to try and address these issues up front before you even start creating your content, is to try and recognize where the issues might be about ownership and to try and reach an agreement between the participants or their employers as to who's going to own the copyright, or who will be entitled to use it and for what, and any financial remuneration that might be involved. And if that involves the assignment of ownership of any copyright or the interest in any copyright, for if you've got joint authors, then you always want to make sure that that's recorded in writing and signed by the people involved. Because as a litigator myself, a big issue we come across with our clients is when a few months or years down the line, when you want to try and actually enforce your copyright to stop someone else misusing it, there can be all sorts of problems trying to work out who the actual owner of the right of the copyright is. And you also have issues where people who might have collaboratively worked together to produce content at one stage might have a falling out, and then might find that you're not able to use the content in the manner you'd like. Another thing which crops up also is the way in which we share content is we're reliant on platforms like YouTube, like LinkedIn, to put out our content to its audience. And there can be sort of issues around the sort of rights that you give those platforms to your content. And I know that's something, Raheem, that you've been having a look at.
Yeah, thanks, David. So I thought it would be good to look at the rights that users give to platforms that they upload their content to. Specifically, I've looked at YouTube and LinkedIn. And obviously, when you sign up to one of these platforms, you agree to their terms and conditions or their user agreement. What users may not know is that within those terms, both of those platforms, YouTube and LinkedIn, grant themselves, well, the user grants them a license to use their content, basically, and the license determines what they can use that content for. So, for example, the license to YouTube provides that by providing content to YouTube,
You grant YouTube a worldwide, non-exclusive, royalty-free, transferable, sub-licensable license to use that content for the purpose of operating, promoting, and improving the service. Essentially, YouTube is saying, if you upload content to our platform, we can use that in our marketing materials, etc., without paying you and without providing any further notice to you. LinkedIn provides similar provisions as well. I'm not going to go into too much detail of the licenses themselves, as they're quite extensive, but some key points to note from both of them are that they permit the platforms to modify the user's original content. So, for example, if they wanted to cut it or change the way it looks to suit their use of it, they're allowed to do that. Although LinkedIn does specify that its modification of your content would be limited to formatting changes and not the meaning of the content itself, whereas YouTube doesn't confirm any such restrictions. Both of the licenses enable the platforms to sublicense their license to third parties. This would most likely be their own marketing content creation agencies. But it's just something to bear in mind that they are allowed to sublicense the use of your content to third parties freely. And lastly, something to bear in mind with LinkedIn is that LinkedIn's license provides that if your profile is public and you upload content to LinkedIn, LinkedIn will enable a feature that will allow other LinkedIn users to embed your content onto their profile without needing to get your consent. This is a form of publishing your content. It's not direct because it would be through an embedded link, and it is distinct from directly allowing the third party to publish your content as if it was their own. But it is something to bear in mind that your content could be shared on other people's profiles without you knowing about it. So it's just something to bear in mind that when you upload content to these platforms, they may be used in ways that you didn't initially anticipate they would be.
And I guess, Raheem, there's not really anything that people can do about that. If you want to share your content on YouTube, you've just got to sign up to their terms and conditions. It's not like a traditional relationship where you can negotiate terms. So that's definitely something that people need to be bearing in mind.
Yeah, that's right. When you sign up, you agree to the terms and conditions, and you can't tell them that you want to amend the terms. They are there and you either sign up to them or not. If you don't want to grant those licenses, or if you want to revoke them at any point, the only way to do that is to take the content off the platforms. The licenses do make clear that their life is for as long as the content is available on the platform. So if you take the content off, then that would be the point at which those platforms can no longer use your materials. But for as long as they are up, those licenses are valid.
Thanks, that's very interesting. Well, so I think we've all heard today that this is a really, really tricky area, and probably much more tricky than most people would assume. So thank you for your time. Please do get in touch if you have any comments or questions. And otherwise, we look forward to sharing our further thoughts on this during part B of IP in a Pod, which will be coming very soon. Thank you.